Talk given Sunday, 7th December 1980. I think every one of us here knows how scholars have divided the religions of the world into the religions which are naysaying to life and others which are yea-saying to life. There is another form also in which the study of religion has been presented as religions of salvation. Salvation through a savior or a teaching or a religious practice. And religions which are more of the nature of a philosophy and an understanding of the nature of life and existence, and thereby giving us indications as to how our total life should be directed and organized, politically, economically, socially, and in our own personal lives as individuals. Now, it is a curious fact that the majority of people in the world are subject to a peculiar superstition, and that is that to live the religious life means essentially to be miserable. This has come about because one is directed to the ideas of relinquishment, of renunciation, and so forth. And what is it that the religions teach us to relinquish and renounce? All that from our childhood onwards we regarded as the pleasurable, as that which brings success to us, and so forth. Now, what we regard as pleasurable and what is good for us and so forth from childhood onwards is related intimately to our sense life, seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, and so on. And therefore, to live religiously means to give up that which we cling to, passionately cling to, as far as the experiencing and the repetition of our sense life is concerned. So religious living is regarded as something gloomy, as something which entails a giving up of the desirable. The desirable as understood when we are young. A few people are free of this delusion, but they do not become free until they have gone through a fairly full experience of the attraction of the senses and the sense life all through their young years. There are very few indeed who are born with sufficient vision, a sufficient sense within themselves that this is all right whilst I'm a child, whilst I'm going through adolescence, in my early adult stages, but it is all leading to something which is quite different. This life, which starts in the usual way, characterizing the life of all people in the early stages, changes into a different kind of life altogether. And such people find that relinquishment and renunciation has nothing to do with something which is disagreeable, gloomy, or painful. Relinquishment and renunciation is a natural process. When one renounces deliberately because of a particular view or because one's religious teacher or guru or whoever it is has said that you must give this up or give that up and so forth, then it always leads to repression with all its evil consequences. But the evolution of the person, of the individual himself, is a natural process in which spontaneously the individual lets go that which he held on to before. So the whole process of transformation is a natural process, and it is a process which leads one from a state of excitement and sensational delight to a state of inward joy and peace and harmony, which is indescribable. Now, the religions of the world have all, or rather, I'll put it this way, the great religious teachers, the founders of the religions, as well as all the other spiritual teachers of the world, have emphasized the place of happiness, of true joy in man's life. Let me just quote from various scriptures in this connection. In the Rig Veda, which has 1,027 hymns, we find this hymn by the sage Kashyapa. He says, "Make me immortal in that realm of eager wish and strong desire, the region of the golden sun, where food and full delight are found." Now, one has to be very careful when reading the translations of these ancient hymns of the Rig Veda, because the literal translation, although correct literally, is misleading. Here he says, "In that, make me immortal in that realm of eager wish and strong desire." But eager wish and strong desire is precisely what the mass of human beings are subject to. And they spend their life energy, sometimes for their whole life, trying to fulfill their wishes and desire. But there are wishes and desires and different wishes and desires. What is the teacher referring to here? He is referring, in short, to that passionate aspiration to realize the fulfillment of the human state, the human being. And bear in mind that the word human means literally the blissful creator. That means that the human being has the same potentiality within himself which is ascribed theoretically in all the great religions of the world to God, or that primordial creative energy which brings forth the whole universe, maintains it, and finally withdraws it into its ultimate state. It's the passionate aspiration to that. That is the wish, that is the desire. You find again and again in the Upanishadic teachings, for instance, that they speak of chandas, this energy, this passion for realization of the truth. And it is also very instructive, very important to observe how the ancient teachers responded to any young person who went to them for instruction, where the spiritual life was concerned. The teacher, of course, had insight. The great teachers just knew a person exactly for what he was the moment he saw him. They had developed that power. And so they usually advised the young man who wanted to tread the path which really belonged to the 40s and the 50s, they advised him to become a householder, to marry, to settle down, and get free of his sexual lumber. And with that, of course, is associated all those ordinary pleasures of life, as we call them, before he started on the path of spiritual development and the fulfillment of himself in the supreme sense. So, this eager wish and strong desire must be understood in that light. And similarly with the next verse, in which he says, "Make me immortal in that realm where happiness and transports, where joys and felicities combine, and longing wishes are fulfilled." These longing wishes belong to the realm of the infinite, of the deathless, not the realm of the finite, which is the realm of death. Then, in the Chandogya Upanishad, the teacher Sanat Kumara was asked by Narada, who went to him for instruction, to demonstrate what the Atma was and what was the supreme fulfillment, the supreme bliss. Narada tells Sanat Kumara that he knows only the word of the scripture, but he has not for himself realized that state of deep meditative consciousness which can remain permanent with a person, which spells ananda, bliss, the supreme peace, as we call it, the peace of God which passes understanding, and so forth. And Sanat Kumara gives a very long teaching, very long discourse, leads him on step by step till he comes to his final statement. Where there is the infinite, there is joy. There is no joy in the finite. Only in the infinite there is joy. Know the nature of the infinite. And he expounds how the infinite is the totality, the one total reality as such, and that is transcendence itself. And since transcendence is omnipresent, the infinite, of course, is omnipresent, and it is only in that mode of awareness in which the individual realizes this infinitude, that he can experience true joy, true happiness, the happiness which doesn't begin, which doesn't go through any progression, and which doesn't die. It can't do that in the infinite. Where the infinite is concerned, there is no measurement possible. There is no comparison possible. There is only the absolute state, so to say. And when the individual consciousness is able to enter that meditative condition through the complete purification of the psyche, then that is what one realizes here and now whilst alive. Yajnavalkya in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad says that whilst we are here only, we may know this. There is no other knowing of it in any mythical hereafter for the individual himself. Then we come to those affirmations by the founders of the great religions themselves as regards what one may call the promise which they hold out. Zarathustra says, "Whoever comes after the follower of holiness, his dwelling shall be the light, the supreme light, which is also the supreme perfection and immortality and joy." The Buddha gives his assurance. A Brahman called Pottapada comes to him with various questions, philosophical questions, questions which give rise to all sorts of speculations and argument and so forth. And the Buddha listens to him very carefully and then answers him at length, at considerable length, because the Pottapada discourse is one of the long discourses, one of the 31 long discourses. And towards the end of the discourse, the Buddha says, "Now it may be, Pottapada, that you think evil dispositions may be put away, the dispositions that tend to purification may increase, one may continue to see face to face, and by himself come to realize the full perfection and grandeur of wisdom, but one may continue sad." And the Buddha proceeds, "Now that, Pottapada, would not be accurate judgment. When such conditions are fulfilled, then there will be joy and happiness and peace, and in continual mindfulness and self-mastery one will dwell at ease." That's what he tells the Brahman Pottapada, who himself was a teacher. He had his own following and his own disciples. And the Buddha, both at the beginning of his ministry and at the end of his ministry, says these words to his disciples: "Therefore, O bhikkhus, you to whom the truths I have perceived have been made known by me, having thoroughly made yourselves masters of them, practice them, meditate upon them, and spread them abroad, in order that pure religion may last long and be perpetuated, in order that it may continue to be for the good and happiness of the great multitudes, out of pity for the world, to the good and the gain and the weal of devas and men." the happiness of the multitudes. So you see that the great religious teachers positively affirmed that the result of the living of the religious life was true joy, true happiness, which doesn't pass away. One doesn't have to seek happiness as such, because if the individual, in the state in which he is, seeks happiness, he will have his own particular ideas of happiness. And since no ordinary individual in the world has a perfect mind, his thoughts and his conceptions are bound to be imperfect. And therefore, his idea and vision of happiness will equally, therefore, be an imperfect one. So that is not the way to true happiness. So it's very interesting to note that emphasis has been laid upon happiness by all the great religious teachers. Perhaps some of the most positive affirmations regarding happiness and joy have been presented in the Zarathustrian scriptures. People know very little about Zarathustrianism. Even today, one comes across people who are surprised to hear the name of Zarathustra or Zarathustrianism. They don't know that there is a religion called Zarathustrianism as such. But in the Gathas, which are the most authentic teachings of Zarathustra, you find all these statements. Raise up the life of man to the height of bliss, O Mazda. Mazda is the other half of the name of God in Zarathustrianism. Perhaps all of you know that in Zarathustrianism, God is named Ahura Mazda. Ahura meaning Lord of life, Mazda meaning Lord of wisdom, Ahura Mazda. And Zarathustra prays, raise up the life of man to the height of bliss, O Mazda, through Vahumana. Vahumana means the good mind, the perfect mind. Through Kshatra, which means creative power, the power of God Himself, and Asha, purity or righteousness. Or if you like to translate it as some scholars have done, the divine law. Asha is the divine law. Now, Vahumana, the good mind, one eminent Zarathustrian scholar who is dead now, but himself a Zarathustrian, a Parsi, a Zarathustrian, who was professor of Sanskrit and Avastan in India, and who studied and obtained his degrees in some of the foremost German universities in Europe. He derives Vahu from Vas, the root Vas, which means to love. To love. And Vahumana is the good mind, is the loving mind. Vahu has both meanings. It means virtue, and therefore allied with the idea of the good, and also it means love, through the loving mind. Transcendental love, not the sort of love that characterizes the vast mass of people, which is so limited and often productive of so much trouble and misery. Then Zarathustra goes on, O Lord of life, for my joy and far-reaching vision, reveal unto me thy incomparable gifts, which are the blessings of the good mind. Then he goes on, for whom didst thou fashion this abundant, joy-giving creation? See the emphasis upon joy right throughout. The whole creation is joy-giving. Now, if one really could appreciate the truth of that, the importance of that, one would naturally become free of chasing after sensational excitements and delights and so on. All the useless things. Wine, women, song, and the whole lot. I think we should add to the wine, women, we should add the wine and men also. And so forth. And he goes on, how may I walk in beatific joy, hand in hand with you, O Mazda, and be your intimate companion. Though through the Holy Spirit, thou art indeed he who molded this joyous creation. Every time Zarathustra talks of the world of creation, he refers to it as joyful, as joyous, and so forth. Who molded this joyous creation for man's sake. It's an idea perhaps which bears some sort of similarity to the creation of the Garden of Eden as being the abode for man. Then he, in another gatha, he goes on, then indeed will I preach the doctrine for thee, O Mazda, when man shall in truth proclaim to the wise that evil comes to the wicked, but bliss to him who upholds righteousness, asha, purity. He who expounds to the wise the holy word is indeed blessed. And then there is a very remarkable statement at the end of the longest of the gathas, a redemptive promise for good doers and evil doers alike. He says, so understand, O mortal men, the decrees which Mazda has ordained regarding happiness and misery. There will be a long period of suffering for the wicked and rewards for the pious, but thereafter eternal joy shall reign everywhere. Now that's a very remarkable statement. I can't recollect any other scripture which has presented quite that. That there will be an adjustment in accordance with the sort of life that the individual leads, but thereafter eternal joy everywhere. And of course scholars have always put Zarathustrianism, classed it amongst the yea-saying to life religions. But I think that's rather a poor way of presenting it. However, then there is a short prayer which deals with happiness and what is the supreme happiness. And it runs thus, virtue is the supreme good, the only true happiness, the happiness that emerges out of him who is foremost in virtue for the sake of the supreme virtue. Now we know only too well from our own experience and from observation of people's lives that they attempt to cultivate virtue, as they call it, in order to obtain some sort of satisfactory reward in a hereafter, to be on the right hand side of God or to enjoy heaven as defined by them. And we know how, for example, the Muslim heaven is presented. All sorts of, in the most earthly possible form. Other religions have presented heaven in a more philosophical, in a more exalted form. But the important point to bear in mind is that the practice of virtue is undertaken by many, many people for the sake of a reward afterwards. It is the desire that I, the person, shall thereby gain something. Deep down in ourselves is this desire for the self. And that desire for the self is a mistaken desire altogether, because by desiring anything for the self, for oneself, one has separated oneself from the rest of the world. It is I and the world. This is for me, and the world can look after itself. And it is this separation in the mind of the individual which ties him down to a worldly consciousness. That worldly consciousness is something which we start with, because we start in our state of ignorance. And that ignorance is responsible for the separative, self-oriented self-consciousness which we all have, and which is extreme, and from which it is very difficult to free ourselves. Consciousness is the fundamental inmost power. It's the supreme, it is identical in actual fact with the supreme creative energy itself. It is consciousness in us which gives rise to our mental states and emotional states and to our actions and beliefs and so forth. Consciousness is something which we cannot know with the brain as such. We talk about consciousness in these terms. Some impressions come to the brain, the physical brain, through the avenues of sense. The brain synthesizes these impressions, and we say, if we are paying attention to the impressions, we say that we are conscious of so-and-so. I see a sunset, or I am talking with somebody, or whatever it may be. But consciousness itself is being identical with the primordial creative power, is something which the brain can never describe, never define, for the very simple reason that the activity of the brain is analytical and it is separative. It is the beclouder, if I may manufacture a word like that. It beclouds the universality of the universe, the unity. The fundamental, ultimate, absolute unity is afflicted by our consciousness being self-oriented and separative. But it is the supreme power in us which gives rise to all that we think, feel, speak, and do in our life, all the aims that we pursue, and so forth. It is only through the purification of all this, through virtue in the supreme sense, not in the limited sense, but through virtue in the supreme sense, that the psyche becomes utterly clean. When the psyche becomes utterly clean, then all our mental, emotional processes no longer interfere with consciousness, the depth of consciousness within us, coming to light and life. And this is the meaning of one of the meanings of being enlightened. What is it that gets enlightened? Not the brain. The brain is extremely limited in its ability, in its scope, and so forth. That doesn't get enlightened. The brain can become purified. It can be allowed to become quiet, not forced to become quiet. And this is where the flaw lies with so many disciplines, including the mistaken presentations of yoga, for example, and various other religious disciplines, where you go through a technique to quieten the brain, to stop it from its ordinary activity, which admittedly is an activity which is not helpful to us in actual fact. But nevertheless, if one carries out, goes through that sort of process, the bedeviling factor is that we go through it in order to produce a result for ourselves, to stop the turmoil of thought, the churning up of the ocean of thought, and all the turmoil and conflict aroused by our emotional states and so forth. When the light of consciousness really, really flares up, then there is associated with it bliss. Ananda, the true meaning of ananda. It is actually experienced then. That is to say, one lives in that state, but one doesn't know with the brain that one is in that state. Anybody who says that, I live in perpetual bliss because I live in God consciousness, is, to put it very gently, guilty of a terminological inexactitude. Don't get misled by all these people. I have heard myself several people in my younger days lecturing along these lines. And I remember once in England, a well-meaning, very charming man he was, a Dutchman, he said, to the whole audience, I know God, I have spoken with God, and He has spoken with me, you see, and so forth. Afterwards, when he threw the meeting open for questions and so forth, I couldn't help asking him, and what language did God use when speaking to you? Was it English or Dutch? And he rather flared up angrily. And we all saw that his behavior was not exactly godlike. However, we have to beware of that sort of thing altogether. So when the psyche is purified, it offers no obstruction to consciousness. And then the light of transcendence fills your whole being right down to its innermost roots, the innermost depth of consciousness, and you are then in the state of true communion, of true union with transcendence itself. Transcendence, which is embodied in each and every one of us, therefore becomes free in its expression, comes to life, and remains unobstructed by the existential psychophysical being. And therefore, whatever that being, wherever he is or with whomever he is an influence for peace, for joy, for the joy which is not any excitement, which is not sensational, but which is a state of extraordinary peace. Peace which is blissful. This, you can see, has nothing to do with pleasure. Obviously not. Because pleasure is something which comes, which springs up in the realm of the finite. Particular things give a pleasurable sensation. Well, that sensation goes through its course and it fades away, it dies. All that belongs to the realm of death. It is the confinement to the deathful state. The whole pursuit of pleasure is one of the greatest mistakes which all mankind has made and continues to make, the pursuit of pleasure, thinking that this is the desirable thing. But true joy, true happiness cannot be pursued. It doesn't begin, it doesn't proceed, it doesn't die. It is eternal. And it is it not significant that even the even masses of people who are ignorant talk in terms of eternal happiness for themselves and for others, eternal. But they don't understand that the context of the eternal and therefore the activity which characterizes the eternal is completely different from the context and the activity which characterizes the non-eternal, the finite, that which comes into being, proceeds and dies. In the state of deathlessness, in that consciousness which is the supreme meditative condition, where there is the true unity, the unification in everything, with everything and in everything, without the slightest sense of separativeness defiling that consciousness of unity. In that state, one has fulfilled the purpose of one's existence, or one of the purposes which one may perhaps define. But this which belongs to the realm of the eternal is indefinable. One can only put it in negative terms. We can know that time is not eternity, and we can also know that the time, what we experience as the timeless state, is also not eternity. Eternity subsumes both time and timelessness. Time and timelessness are modes of our experiencing because our consciousness is what it is. If our consciousness really is allowed, we allow it to get fully liberated, then we can live through time and the timeless state in the background of eternity itself. Eternity is something quite different from time and timelessness. People have, most philosophers, most teachers have associated or even identified the experiencing of the timeless state as the experiencing of the eternity of the divine. But it is not the eternity of the divine, because the individual, the living individual, enters a timeless state at one moment of time, and he ultimately has to come out of it, because the existential being, the psychophysical organism, can stand the situation only thus far and no further. It needs food, it needs rest, and so forth, and one wakes up out of that, back to the ordinary state of consciousness in which we live. Now, in the teachings of yoga, and all of you who are interested in yoga should try to bear in mind all the time just precisely what one is aiming, what one is moving to. I first said aiming at, but an aim by me as I am is a limited aim. It's the aim of the imperfect being, the tainted psyche, subject to desires and passions and whatnot and whatnot. One has no aim. Life has no aim whatsoever. It is. It just does everything quite naturally and spontaneously. And that is the indescribable, blissful peace and joy of the totality itself. So, if we practice yoga, and by practicing yoga I don't mean merely the physical practice of yoga, which is one essential point, but it is the ABC, so to say, only of the real nature of yoga, which is concerned. If you study your yoga teachings very, very carefully, you will see that they are fundamentally concerned with the purification of the psyche and thereby cleansing the entire being. And this is where the physical practice is a help, because it cleanses the physical body, especially the nervous system and so forth. And therefore, with the cleansing of that, and the coordinating of the activity of the ductless glands with the nervous system and with the activity of the brain, then the vehicle, the existential being, is a properly prepared vehicle to manifest the release of transcendence out of that very vehicle. So you see, then in consciousness one realizes one's aloneness, not loneliness. Loneliness comes into being because we are self-concerned. If we were not self-concerned at all, we'd never feel lonely. Our aloneness means our one onlyness. And that one onlyness characterizes transcendence itself, use the word God if you like, characterizes the entire one total reality, that aloneness. And in that aloneness is the ultimate and supreme self-containedness. It is an extraordinary thing to experience. It will come to you if you let it come. If you say to yourself, oh, I want to seek this state and experience it, and have the experience of the totality, there is no such thing as an experience of the totality, because that is a limited and a finite thing. Any experiencing like that is a finite thing. It doesn't belong to the realm of the infinite. And when it is gone, and you feel miserable. And you try to bring it back by this means or that means and so forth. All futile endeavors directed towards self-satisfaction, which only cuts us off from the totality. Therefore, virtue in the true sense, in the supreme sense, is this allowing of the supreme good, the ultimate good, naturally and spontaneously to function through us by becoming fully aware and observant of all that in us which obstructs transcendence, the totality, this ultimate truth, from manifesting freely through us. But if we see that, we begin so to live by using our own good sense, that we can allow that divine joy to permeate our innermost being, which will always be something that no evil can really penetrate and cause us hurt.